Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, Bob and I are together now, but we will be separate later, right? Bob takes a trip to the Holden Arboretum near Cleveland, Ohio, right? Pretty famous place.
Yeah, it's a place I've always wanted to go and I've heard a lot about, and it was worth going, frankly. We took a big old plant trip into Ohio, and it's up near Lake Erie, but had 100 acres in 1931. Now they've got 3,500 acres, 25 ponds, a lake, 20 miles of hiking trails, 20,000 plants, wildflowers, a great rhododendron garden, and the butterfly garden, which I spent the most time in. So, well worth
it. It's a good time of the year to enjoy that.
Spoke with a man named Charles Trubessing. He's the chief horticulturist up there.
All right. So we'll get a taste of Holden Arboretum here coming up in the first part of the show. And then I have a conversation with a great author. She's just written a new book. It's called A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love Plants We Don't Want. Nancy Gift, she's originally from Lexington, trained in as a weed scientist at the University of Kentucky, and then she went on for graduate degrees and all this. But it really, if you've got somebody who you want to stop worrying about a weedy lawn, or somebody that you want to stop using herbicides, they should really read this book because it's like a journal. It's a very philosophical but smart look at what weeds are, what they're telling us. You know what I mean? That
neat.
Like a weed is really just a plant at a place,
right?
She argues, which she's, I mean, absolutely. So a weed to you is not a weed to me, or like chicory on the side of the road is not really a weed to me,
right?
But then chicory in my perennial bed might be, you know what I mean? So it's got, we got to look at it a little bit more.
Yeah,
big picture.
The dandelions don't know the difference between
exactly.
a lawn,
you know,
and
what
where
I
they're
mean?
Supposed to be or not be. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an interesting, it's a very interesting philosophical sort of look, and educational, of course, but it's a nice read along the lines of many of our favorite naturalists,
yep.
The stuff that we've read in the past. So good conversation with Nancy Gift. So that'll be coming up in part two of Homegrown. So we hope that you will stay with us. In the meantime, Bob, what is going on in your garden?
One of the reasons I love to garden is you're always finding new things and interesting things. And as a result of the big windstorm last September, I lost a big old sugar maple and had some other big water maples cut down. And I was cleaning up around the water maple this past weekend and found a bunch of bulbs. I think they're daffodil bulbs tucked way under the tree, how it expanded about 3 or 4 feet.
Uh-huh.
And these poor things haven't been able to bloom for I don't know how long.
Right.
And I'm digging them out, and they're nice size bulbs. You could, you know, they're 2 inches across, some of them.
It's still viable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, who planted these daffodils?
Mm-hmm.
Who was this person? You know, they lived in my house. I lived in their house, whatever you want to say. And so I've got about 20 of these bulbs, and I've set them free.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to plant them out again.
That's nice.
And next spring, I'm going to report back what they
That's
are.
That's really nice.
Because it just was so neat, and they were just mashed in there so tight they couldn't even breathe. And oh, boy, I just felt like a liberator or something.
Right. No, and that somehow there's going to be some sort of history revealed once they see light again.
My house is 130 years old.
Yeah.
And these were planted at least
70
years ago.
That's
so cool. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, nice.
About the Wish Estate, what's up?
Well, two interesting things. One, you know, a lot of the baby birds are starting to fledge.
Yep.
And are you familiar with cowbirds at all?
I've seen them. I mean,
okay, cowbirds, they take advantage of other birds because they'll knock their eggs out of the nest, and then they'll lay their egg in the nest, and then that little bird raises the egg, and then they go out and party all the time, right? So
I know some people like that.
So Sunday brunch, Andy and I are sitting there eating our poached eggs, of course. It had to be some sort of egg
Not
dish.
Not cowbird eggs, I trust.
No. And out on the deck, you know, where there's some bird feeders, we hear all this. I mean, it was so noisy that morning. Just birds were like, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, good grief, what's going on? So this bird was carrying on. And mostly there's just all these little different types of finch out there. So I look and he's bigger, but he's screaming and he's flapping his wings like a little baby bird would. And, you know, like their little beak, like, give me some food, how they do.
Right.
So then this other little tiny finch, who's grown up though, but smaller than this little bird, goes over and hands it some seed. Plus the fact that there's a bunch of bird seed right on the ground in front of this little baby bird.
Uh-oh.
So literally, it was like one of those moments where you go, thunk. Of course, that's a baby cowbird that's been brought up by this finch family.
Look at
that's why he's squawking at this smaller but grown-up mama finch to feed me.
Yeah.
She does. And then they fly back over to the tree.
That's remarkable.
And I've never seen it, you know, in action quite like that.
I've read about it.
But it was just so funny because it totally was acting like a little baby. Feed me, feed me, feed me.
Oh.
And then the mama is like half its size. And it just, you know, didn't quite compute kind of thing.
That's what my mom felt, actually.
Yeah, I bet she did. No kidding. What happened here?
Who is this
kid? So I saw in live in action a baby cowbird being raised by a finch that's smaller than it.
That's wonderful.
Okay. And then, okay, serendipity, I guess we call it. You know how you've never seen anything in your entire life and then all of a sudden you see it everywhere?
Yeah.
So we have a great listener in Duke who lives in Madison, Indiana, and we email frequently back and forth, and he had emailed a picture of this bug that he didn't know what it was. I wasn't really sure. So finally determined that it was what you call a predatory stink bug.
Ooh, I don't like that.
Never seen him before in my life. Then Andy and I are cutting down the last crab apple that got smashed up from the ice storm.
Right.
What do we find? Andy says, look at this bug. What is it?
A predatory stink bug.
And normally I'd be like, I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah. It was a predatory stink bug.
Wow.
And they're good bugs. So there's two of them. There's one in Madison, Indiana, and Madison, Indiana, and one in Simpsonville.
I think
they're related somehow. It's probably why we don't see them very often.
No, they're good bugs, though, huh?
They're good bugs.
They're predatory and they stink, but they're good.
Yeah, and Mom, we had put it in a little thing to double check its identity, like a little covered thing. And when we opened it, it didn't stink like stinky stink, but it stunk like an organic-y, leafy smell.
They need a name change.
I think PR. So. Exactly. They're real pretty.
Like the lovable perfume bug.
Yeah, they were really
I'd
pretty.
I'd buy that in a minute.
They were real pretty. You could, actually.
Okay.
Learn how to spread how pretty they are. Maybe we could try to get a new name for them. If you head out to Udell, they are having a garden photography workshop. Mm-hmm. July 25th from 9 to 3. There is a fee and you'd want to, you know, pre-register. So you can go to our website at wfpl.org or go to Udell's website to check out more information on that photography workshop.
Another one near and dear to my heart, Ralph Archer, the local fern guru, is going to have every Monday from 8:30 to 10:30 for the next few weeks have fern tours at Whitehall off Lexington Road. So contact Whitehall for information. But if you want to know something about ferns,
that's the place to go, and he's the
man. Ralph's the man.
Absolutely. I think they're doing that through the month of July. It may extend, so just get details through Whitehall. Not really sure how long they're going to be doing that. And then also on July 25th, Bob, I'm going to be out at Slowpoke Farm. You've met Hill and Anna Bleemel before.
Oh, yeah.
They're fabulous people. But you do, it's like, usually have the little workshops from 10 till noon, and then they have this great country lunch. So I'll be giving a talk there at 10 o'clock. They're out on Cedar Grove Road in Shepherdsville. And you can go to their website, Slowpoke Farm, or ours for information on how to register for that as well.
You're not going to cook lunch?
I would be delighted to help Anna cook lunch, but I'm busy talking to the people.
I'd help you eat it.
Okay.
It's my part.
It's really good food. I know I'll be bringing some corn home for sure from the farm. So, all right, Bob. So you've traveled recently. In his retirement, he's decided to travel at least once a month.
What retirement?
And we get the benefit of that, of course, because you just returned from Ohio.
I was up in northern Ohio near Lake Erie visiting the Holden Arboretum. Had a great time and met a very interesting man. Continuing the homegrown journey across the United States and the world, I ventured up to northern Ohio to the Holden Arboretum near the shores of Lake Erie to talk to a man named Charles Tubasing, who's the chief horticulturist here at Holden Arboretum, which is one of the country's great arboretums, certainly one of the best in the Midwest, and I'd like to have folks come up here and check it out for themselves. Charles, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Okay, let's catch up a little bit on your past, how long you've been at the Holden and what brought you here.
I've been here, this is my 23rd year, it'll be 23 end of July. And I came because my goal was really to work in, I grew up in Indiana and work in an arboretum in the Midwest where I really felt comfortable, and particularly an arboretum that where the main idea was growing a wide variety of trees.
Okay, and give us a little history of Holden before we talk about what's here and why.
Well, Holden officially started in 1930. It was an idea of Albert Fairchild Holden, who was a mining engineer. He died in 1913 and left his estate in a life trust to support his two daughters and then to go towards the founding of an arboretum. His daughters lived to a ripe old age, and as a result, his sister decided, Roberta Holdenbowl, who lived locally here, decided not to wait, and she worked with the lawyers and the trustees and such, and got the arboretum started here in 1930. She contributed 100 acres and then got the arboretum officially started.
And the total acreage here is about 3,600 acres, of which maybe 400 is what the usable part, the central part, where people can actually wander around and visit and see different displays and trees and so forth. Give us an overview of the different areas that are here that people can come see.
Well, we actually have natural areas too. The 400 to 600 acres of gardens and also meadows, and then we've got a big bulk of the rest of that is native woodland. We've got miles and miles of trails to go through those areas too. And in the garden areas, we've got a garden that shows different hedges you can use in the area here. That leads into our display garden, which is sort of an all seasons garden. With a mixture of woody display. We have a big lilac planting and viburnums, and then a lot of other woody plants that have interest the rest of the year. We have a wildflower garden that shows our native wildflowers of the region, woodland part, and then a dune garden, a fen garden, a rockery, prairies, and a bog, so showing all the different kinds of habitats where our native plants grow. We have a butterfly garden, which is really good during the summer, built around two ponds directly behind our visitor center, so easy access, and we have a patio that overlooks it. Utilizes plants that both feed the larvae of pollinating insects and butterflies in particular, and also a lot of flowers that attract hummingbirds as well.
Well, let's talk first about, we spend a lot of time in a really wonderful rhododendron and azalea garden, which both the a lot of natives in there, all the more domesticated varieties too, but talk about the rhododendron garden, what time of year people could come see it, and what they'd see if they came here.
Yeah, the rhododendron garden's about 30 acres in an understory of an oak forest, mainly red oak, and its bloom starts there in April, and it peaks probably about Memorial Day weekend, end of May, but then there's mountain laurels that come in after that in June, and other associated things, and it's just a great shade garden, and it's got a real good feel to it, to where people like to come and take walks through it through the rest of the summer, because it's always cooler in there and quieter.
Okay, and then there's another area I really liked a lot. It was a lot of tall oak trees with grass beneath it. It was very peaceful and calm, and they lost a great big oak tree here, about 150 years old, and what they did is they saved the stump, and, well, Charles, you tell us what happened to make the place so special after the tree fell down.
Yeah, this was a red oak, and it was a low branch one, so it missed the foresters passed by when they logged this area probably 100 years ago or so. And the oak collapsed a few years back in the spring on a totally still day. It had some structural damage that it let rot in, and it fell down. And so it's the stump's 4 to 5 feet across, and we cut it off, and rather than destroy it completely, we cut it off at about 3 feet or so, and a local wood carver, he uses a chainsaw and other tools, carved green men and woodland spirits and squirrels and other woodland animals into the flare of the tree that was left there, and then waxed that so that they'd shed water and it would resist rotting.
And then we went from there, we toured around to the rest of the arboretum here. Talk a little more about the things we saw between that oak grove and back here at the butterfly garden.
Well, we went around Blueberry Pond. All of our ponds are man-made on the grounds, and Blueberry Pond is area where it's got plantings around of plants that are really appropriate to waterside plantings that like moist soil, like sweet band magnolia and clethra and itea, the summer sweet. And we passed through an area where there's a grove of ponderosa pines that were planted back in the 30s, and they're rather tall with small crowns. And initially the idea was to simulate a Rocky Mountain forest, and that sort of was neglected over the years. And we're using it now effectively to provide a sheltered overstory for things like magnolias that with large leaves that need some wind shelter, red buds in the understory, some of the newer different types like the white-flowered red buds and Appalachian red, which is just an incredible hot pink color in the spring, and some of the striped bark maples that really don't like to see sunlight on their bark and live longer if you can provide a bit of shade.
Yeah, and the paths just kind of flow from the woods to open areas and back into woody areas again and so forth. But they all eventually lead back to the visitor center, and behind of which is the butterfly garden we spoke about earlier. So let's talk about that. First, the planning. This was something else years ago, and they decided to make it a dedicated butterfly garden. How did this happen? How do you convert what was basically, I guess, a road at one point in this butterfly garden with two ponds?
Well, it's right directly behind our visitor center. When we built the visitor center in 80, it was before I came, but as I understand, the funds sort of ran out. And so we basically had the lawn slope off the back of the building. And then we had a donor that graciously provided funds as a memorial to his wife. And there were two ponds back there, and essentially then we designed a garden around that. And it was a nice combination of our horticulture and conservation staff working along with our education department to really theme the garden. And this was the first garden where we'd actually worked with our interpretive staff to say what messages we wanted to teach before we actually designed the garden. And there's lots of displays we have outside there. We take school groups through and interpret, tell kids about pollinators. And sort of the whole web of the ecosystem, so that it's great to be able to build a garden with a theme in mind and messages you want to teach, rather than sort of putting in a garden and then saying, well, what can we do with this now and how can we interpret it?
Well, Charles, let's talk about some specific plants, because I'd never seen any of these things before. I was kind of amazed. One was a Rose of Sharon that grows like a small shrub and doesn't reseed around too much.
Right, and that one, the one that's in the butterfly garden, is called Tosca. And there were two introductions at the same time, Tosca and Lohengrin, and they came out of winter tour gardens in Delaware. They were supposedly hybrids with a really tender tropical species and the regular Rose of Sharon, and I'm not sure I buy that, but the leaf's different enough, it's just not Hibiscus syriacus, and the cross apparently was wide enough that it's made them essentially sterile. We never see seedlings under them, which is great. Tosca's got sort of a rose pinky mauve flower, good size with a darker eye in it. Lohengrin's white, with a red eye in that, and I know I've seen that, for instance, in the Cincinnati Zoo. It's used a lot in the landscape there, and very durable in the landscape.
Yeah, it's about the size of a small crabapple. It's an amazing plant that I want to try myself now. Another one you see from time to time, I really caught my eye, was Verona castrum. It's a hybrid. It looks a little bit like a vitex almost, a really interesting tall perennial.
Yeah, we've got a native Verona castrum, Virginicum, Culver's root, and there's a native one to Asia, Verona castrum, Sibericum, and there's been some hybrids produced, I think, particularly in Europe. And there's one with really tall branch spikes called Lavender Tower. It came out of Germany. It's got a name like Lavendelturm or something like that, but it translates to Lavender Tower, kind of pale lavender spikes. And these are tall perennials, and they're just great for butterflies and in a mixed perennial border.
Another one we see here used really well is Jacob Klein, a former perennial plant of the year. It's a real tall flower with a bright red bud that attracts, I guess, hummingbirds as well as butterflies and maybe bees too.
And yeah, the Monarda. And here, like a lot of places through the upper Midwest and other areas in the South, the Monardas are bee bombs. Oftentimes they're plagued with powdery mildew, and Jacob Klein's essentially free of that, and it's got a very clear bright red flower and red bracts at the base of the petals, so it's really a nice color.
And then milkweed is a plant you always associate with butterflies, and there's several different kinds out here. And talk some about the Nadia, another plant you don't see enough of. It's a little bright kind of red marble-shaped flower.
Yeah, that's Nadia. That's K-N-A-U-T-I-A, Nadia macedonica. It's very much like the scabious. In recent years, we had scabiosa, butterfly blue, and other ones are introduced. And they tend to be kind of short-lived, and they're really susceptible to winter wet. And the Nadia's got a cranberry red flower, but it's got those long stems that wave in the breeze, like the very much like the scabiosa. So it's great for the movement. Anything that moves in the garden in the way of flowers is very, very nice.
And what's really neat about looking at these flowers is they're, for lack of a better word, kind of stuffed in against the hillside, so there's not a lot of room for the weeds to grow. We haven't talked much about the culture of creating the butterfly garden, so what plans should somebody begin with? How would an everyday gardener begin a butterfly garden and end up looking something like this?
Well, a lot of the plants we use in there are ones that are pretty easy to grow. We didn't do much soil amendment, and the soil's not really great there. It tends to be on the clay side. So we relied a lot on prairie plants and some of the European hybrids that were derived from those. And so things like Rudbeckia, and the black-eyed season, and Echinacea, and Monarda. We use a lot of the cat mints, the Nepeta, Walker's Low, and there's several different kinds of those, which have a fairly long bloom season. They tolerate the clay and grow really well. In fact, the Rudbeckia, both the Rudbeckia and the Monarda seem to reseed so thick that we really have to thin them out there. they get a little, they'll choke everything else out if you give them half a chance. And you have more leaf diseases with Rudbeckia if it's thick too, so you really need to thin it out. But they tend to get in and elbow everything else out of the way. And the whole idea is to have a nice thick planting so we don't have quite so many weeds to pull.
Okay, let's go back to the Holden itself here. If people come here, say, in midsummer, late summer, what typically can they find to do? What events for the kids and for the adults as well?
You know, we've got always, you know, for one, always have the gardens going. We've got guided tours. We have trained guides and tram tours that people can walk, but we also have tram tours that will hold six or eight people and with a guide that drives around and can do an orientation tour or a longer tour to go through there. In the fall, we have one of our favorite events, and it doesn't have a whole lot to do with gardens, but it's called Goblins in the Gardens. It's sort of our Halloween event. We decorate the core of the arboretum, and we have families can come in with the children in costume, and we have pets in costume. We have a pet event too, and we it happens all the way. It goes up to dusk. We've got some pretty spooky trees that we light up, and we turn our hedge garden into a maze, and it's been one of our more popular events. In fact, the first year or two we had it, we had to kind of gear up because we had a backup at our entrance with people coming for it. So it's a great event in terms of families being able to come and have a safe event to do it at Halloween.
Yeah, in case you're wondering, the Holden Arboretum is about 30 miles east of Cleveland, very close to Lake Erie, which gives it a lot of benefit, I guess, of the lake effect here. And you can drive here from Louisville in 7 hours. It's only 5 hours from Cincinnati, and it's certainly worth the trip. So, Charles Chubesting, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Come see us.
Charles Chubesting is chief horticulturist at Holden Arboretum in Northern Ohio. For more information on the Arboretum or Charles, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy, and I am here without Bob for once. From time to time, that happens. But I'm here with Nancy Gift, who is you're from Kentucky, right, Nancy?
I grew up in Lexington, born and raised.
Yeah, but she's her summer visit to her in-laws, I think.
In-laws and my parents both.
Okay, great. So she's come into the studio to talk about a new book that she's authored. It's called A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love Plants We Don't Want. Nancy's an assistant professor of environmental studies and acting director of the Rachel Carson Institute at Chatham University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where she also lives with her husband and two daughters. Nancy's originally from Lexington, as she said. She also received her degree as a weed scientist from the University of Kentucky, so a hometown hero to be sure. But welcome back to Kentucky and welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh. It's so nice to be here.
Great. I really, really enjoyed the book. It's a personal and rather persuasive look, I think, at how we treat weeds in America, how we view weeds in America. Give us your philosophy on weeds, because there is a little bit of a contradictory nature, as you admit, mm-hmm. to your weed scientist background, right. Even being a pesticide applicator at one point, and your philosophy today.
Right. Well, one of the most interesting turning points for me was first hearing that the definition of a weed is a plant out of place. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, that seems strange because there you'll see these lists of top 10 worst weeds in the U.S. or sure. top 10 weeds of agricultural fields, weeds everybody loves to hate, mm-hmm. worst offenders. But then it turns out that really it's about the plant in that place, literally. Wendell Berry writes about a sense of place, but really that weed is either good or bad depending on exactly where it is. Mm-hmm. And I think in most lawns, there's really not much concern over any weed you can mow over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Give us a little kind of background in terms of the weed scientist part of you, mm-hmm. and then we'll talk more about the mom side of you and the ecology of your own backyard and some of these different experiences that have shaped your views right. of trying to stay away from herbicides, in fact.
Right. Well, the weed scientist background fed into the fact that I was in school in agriculture. And so in agriculture, the concern about weeds is always about profit.
Sure.
You spray the weed if the amount it costs you to spray that weed is less than the amount you would lose from keeping that weed in your field. Mm-hmm. And so if you're growing corn or soybean or wheat or anything, you have to calculate how much that crop's worth and how much the herbicide would cost and think about how many weeds are out there. You actually go out and count. Mm-hmm. And a farmer would never spray to the last weed. Mm-hmm. But I remember in class learning from Dr. Witt that you're never going to be able to value that weed the same way in a lawn, the same way you can in an agricultural field. There's no economic value placed on a lawn. Mm-hmm. And that really came home to me at one point later on. I was trying to get a job in weed science, and I'd rejected the options of working for Monsanto and Novartis. And I had applied for a job doing weed science research under a turf grass researcher. Mm-hmm. And we were looking at these 3x3 plots of lawns, and they had some weeds in them. And I kept thinking, why are we spraying these? Mm-hmm. Why do I actually care about these weeds? And of course, I didn't get the job. I'm sure you could sense that I didn't quite care enough. But that was a moment for me where I realized that those weed science skills could be used in another context.
There you go. Exactly. So how did you sort of allow that to meet the needs of this new context?
Right. Well, part of it was the fact that when my husband got a job at University of Pittsburgh and mm-hmm. then I got the job at Chatham University, that it was pretty clear that there was no land grant institution anywhere near Pittsburgh. And so if I was going to use those weed science skills, I'd better figure out a new way to think about them. Mm-hmm. But what we were living in was suburbia. And I'd grown up in suburbia in Lexington, and that's a very familiar context to me. And it always seemed strange when I was in weed science that I hadn't grown up on a farm. But suddenly when living in suburbia, I realized that the weed science background actually gave me an insight that the average suburban resident didn't have. Mm-hmm. When I said weed science to anyone in my neighborhood, they looked at me kind of funny.
So what do you do with that?
Yes, yeah. Not that weed, I have to clarify.
Oh, right.
Yes, especially being from Kentucky.
Exactly.
But the suburban background really clarified that this was a new message that people hadn't heard and that my insight on weeds might be different from mm-hmm. anybody else's. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so living in suburbia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, two daughters, a husband, a community center nearby,
right.
sort of starts the story that Nancy tells, just to kind of lay out the way the book's organized. You take it weed by weed in a categorical sort of way, but it's your story, your context, your thoughts on it. How do you break it down and decide what weed has enough value to stay and what weed needs to absolutely go, multiflora rose being one of them?
Right. Actually, one of the hardest for me to decide on in my own yard was dandelion. And that is because I like to think of my yard as a showcase of beautiful weeds. Mm-hmm. And so in using it as a showcase, I'm always torn between the fact that I know that plenty of people observe dandelion as an ugly plant mm-hmm. and that at the same time, a dandelion is going to exist in any yard in which you don't spray herbicides mm-hmm. and frankly, in any yard in which you don't go out and pull them. Now, mm-hmm. I will say in my mother-in-law's lawn in Bardstown, she's pulled enough of them, but that was years and years and years of work to really get close to eradicating them. Mm-hmm. So with dandelions, I feel this constant pull between thinking about what the neighbors observe and knowing that I myself don't actually mind them. Mm-hmm. And for a couple of years, I was pulling them from the front yard and not from the back. And then I was pulling them on the side of a neighbor who seemed a little grumpy about our yard, mm-hmm. but not in other places. And then finally, I decided that if I thought that my weedy yard was beautiful, I had to live with those dandelions. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's not hard for me to do, but I'm always aware of what that outside perception is. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of leads us to this interesting notion of community. How does the notion of community sort of play a role in, you know, right. conforming to some rules that, I mean, there's city, you talked about a city ordinance.
Right.
That
against chicory, in fact.
Yeah.
It is so complex because part of my notion of community sometimes involves community values that other people may not share, just as they have community values that I don't share. So one of my values in the community is that the water would be clean of herbicides. Mm-hmm. We all end up drinking the water that comes from the river, the water that goes over my lawn, it goes to the river, that goes back into our water supply. It's the same situation you have here in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And so to me, community values involve helping keep that water as clean as I can. And yet, for somebody else, those community values involve the aesthetics of the neighborhood, what they perceive as property values. And so community value is always trying to place what my kids can do in the lawn, what I can drink out of my tap, and also how my neighbors and I feel about each other. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty complicated set of values to work with.
Yeah.
I think that's part of why in the book there end up being different compromises about different weeds. And you and I were speaking a few minutes before this started about the spraying poison ivy. And that's a situation where I really had to balance carefully, and it ended up coming out the other way because I want my kids to be able to play outside. Mm-hmm. And so I had to think, what's my premier value in this particular situation? Just like with the weeds, each one is in a particular place, mm-hmm. not just a broad sweeping value of let's spray that, it's a weed.
Right. So, Nancy, share with us some of your stories about some of your favorite weeds. And I think at this point, we can't even really call them weeds if they're in your yard because they're not in the wrong place.
That's right. I chose to have them there.
That's right. So, because you tell a great story about your love of violets growing up, even in your parents' yard, they never sprayed. There were always violets. But one day, returning home for a visit, and one of the first things you noticed in your mother's yard was that there was no violets.
Right.
Which is only possible if...
if they sprayed.
Yeah.
And it was a really shocking realization. I think I'd ignored it for a year or two because they told me that they'd had their yard reseeded.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a short time, I just ignored the straight, plain grass because I could think to myself, well, that's because it was reseeded. But about a year and a half after that, I looked at their lawn and I thought, you know, when I see lawns like this, usually I assume they were sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and asked my mom some questions, and she said she'd told the person, Patrick, that she didn't want to have anything sprayed, but she was kind of vague about what went on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, I'd like to see the receipts. And so the receipts, of course, told the tale. But what I found surprising was how easy it was for my mom to ignore that evidence. And one of the things that happens when an herbicide, when a lawn service treats your lawn with an herbicide, is they may give you the receipt, but they treat it as if this is just a monthly bill kind mm-hmm. of thing. It's not that they're asking you to pay for the herbicide that they sprayed. And also that the herbicides they use are labeled with a name that's going to be pretty tough for you to actually
right.
figure out what it is.
Because these are applications that are not available to the average homeowner. You have to be certified. It's a whole different sort of ballgame than what we would do ourselves,
right.
even if we chose to do it.
Right. And if you buy a if you buy a drug at the drugstore, there's always an active ingredient listed.
Mm-hmm.
But when they spray your lawn, they're not giving you the active ingredient of those herbicides. The herbicide companies actually change trade names of their herbicides so frequently that it's really hard to tell what's been put on.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to try to tell people to read the label and get the information when I was working in Ag Extension. And then with homeowners, I realized that they just aren't going to read that 6-point font label.
Mm-hmm.
It's not reasonable to ask. And if somebody wants to read the label and really try to figure out what's being sprayed and evaluate
it,
that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I think the simpler solution for most lawns, since there's real no moral imperative to spray your lawn,
mm-hmm.
and it's simpler just to avoid them entirely.
Mm-hmm. Where weeds come up and what kind of weeds come up tell you a great deal about the ecology, the environment, the soil, you know, whether it's good, bad, shady, wet.
Right. I think one of the first steps in looking at that plant out of place is thinking about what is growing here already and why. And I think a good gardener often does that in the beginning by sowing a lot of different plants and seeing what does well in their garden. The weeds can help you short-circuit that process a little bit. If you look at those weeds, you can say, this soil is compacted. There are easy online guides. I've seen plenty of charts that'll tell you what kind of weeds indicate what. For example, there's a lot of plantain in one section of our yard where we tend to walk in that same path over mm-hmm. and over.
So it's
compacted. Fairly compacted soil. And so we know that if we're going to get rid of the plantain, if we did decide that we didn't want that plantain there, then we'd have to figure out some way to change the path, put stones in, mm-hmm. somehow alleviate that compaction problem. Otherwise, we're just going to end up with more plantain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another example of why the herbicides can be kind of a losing battle. But the nice thing is that the weeds can tell you that without going through that losing battle and mm-hmm. spending the money on it or risking your health from it.
Mm-hmm. You told a story, too, about visiting some friends in Greenville, South Carolina, in a new subdivision, and their sort of consternation over their yard and all the weeds that were there. And you sort of described the whole layer of things as, you know, a cake.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens under construction. Can you sort of describe right. the situation that you found in Greenville?
In new suburbs, typically the developers will remove all the topsoil because that's in their way. And of course, topsoil compacts and changes and all of that. And so it makes it harder to build on. And so the developers remove the topsoil. And typically, instead of putting back all the topsoil they removed when they've built the houses, what they put back is sod. And so what you have is this healthy mat of roots that was healthy because it was growing on a much better soil sure. than they're putting it on. And then
it's
they
like
try
thrown on concrete almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is exactly like that. And the soil is so compacted underneath there, both from the pressure of the construction machines and also just it's not the layer of soil that you're supposed to put plants on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the weeds are going to reappear in that subdivision. You would almost think from the way the weeds will grow in that subdivision that the herbicide companies had contracted with the contractors to put in the plants that way, because they're uh-huh. guaranteeing that the only way to get the kind of lawn that I even think of as a healthy, diverse lawn is going to be to either add topsoil or you're going to have to use the shortcut of mm-hmm. spraying to get rid of those inevitable weeds.
But it still doesn't get rid of the fact that there's concrete underneath that sod.
That's right. And
know,
so the real solution
so
is always to build up the soil.
Right. So, and that kind of brings me back to that community garden sort of thing. And you were talking about vegetables, but you really were talking, not really vegetables. The true conversation was about wild garlic and the weeds that we can in fact consume and eat and
right.
you know enjoy
right.
but there's again these unwritten rules of you don't have a vegetable garden in your front yard, and then there's that the knowledge that you have, there's that fear of harvesting things in community spaces because you don't know the history of the soil,
right?
You know, all of these things sort of combine to either create a weedy situation whether you want mm-hmm. it or not, or
right.
one where you can't trust
right.
harvesting from it because you don't know what went on in that community space. Or people might think you're weird
right.
because you're out picking wild onions and taking right. them home, putting them in a little bag and taking them home.
It's an interesting class issue that foraging wild plants is considered something that poor people do. And
mm-hmm.
maybe, I don't know if it started with Yule Gibbons or if it just started with the fact that you typically would see somebody who was poor more likely to need wild greens.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is a lot of those greens are healthier than what we purchase in the grocery. And we talk so much about local food and slow food, and I really like those movements. And at the same time, unfortunately, they've largely been movements of the rich.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite tidbits that I couldn't expand too much more than I did was about a student who was a woman from one of the poor neighborhoods of Pittsburgh, and she took one of my classes, and she drew the connection to me between soul food and slow food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think weeds fit very nicely into soul food. It's mm-hmm. something that is locally available, it's free, and yet you can nourish your family with it. At the same time, I remember that the vegetable garden space that my parents rented near University of Kentucky was formerly the weed science plots.
Uh-huh.
And so not only were there a whole lot of weeds coming up there, but who knows what had been on that soil beforehand.
Yeah, so. All the pesticide applications that would have been part of
right.
the study.
And experimental pesticide applications
sure.
as well.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about a few other weeds because we're running out of time. Your favorite weed, your least favorite weed, ultimately?
A favorite would be a toss-up between clover and violet.
Mm-hmm.
And clover is an interesting one because clover was actually included in lawn seed mixes until they introduced 2,4-D.
Mm-hmm.
But clover is a nitrogen fixer. It would help increase the health of your grass. It tends to be more tolerant of dogs than many grasses are.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful low-growing plant, and actually, if you had a pure stand of clover, it wouldn't require much mowing at all.
Mm-hmm.
So clover's a lovely one for that, and we talked about the violet. Least favorite weed, that's a tough one. I mean,
sorry to ask thee.
No, not at all. I'd have to say, actually, Japanese knotweed.
Okay.
And it's not typically a lawn problem, but it would be edges of lawns, and Japanese knotweed is the only good thing I can say about it is that bees make really good honey from it, but the Japanese knotweed has an incredible propensity to spread, and nobody's really found a good solution for it.
Mm-hmm.
That once it's taken hold on a roadside right of way, then it's very hard to get rid of it and expensive to get rid of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I find that one very frustrating.
Yeah.
And it was introduced.
Yeah. Is there a happy medium between embracing certain weeds? Okay, I have to admit, I mean, you write about chickweed, and I prefer chickweed not to be right. around, honestly.
Right.
So how do I reconcile the, okay, I can appreciate you a little bit here yes. and there, but then I don't really want you to take over
right.
everywhere.
My understanding of why I would dislike chickweed in my vegetable garden as much as anybody else does, and certainly why it's not so appealing in the lawn, is partly that it's an annual. And so again, with that plant out of place idea in mind, that if you're growing something that's designed for perennials, that a perennial weed is, in my view, in the lawn, less of a problem than an annual weed, because the annual weed is going to have a life cycle with a season. Mm-hmm. And when that season's over, there's going to be a bare spot. Mm-hmm. So to me, the chickweed in the lawn
can, in fact, even continue to do right. well in that bare spot.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And so if I'm trying to seed my lawn with something that I want, it's going to be a perennial plant in the lawn.
Gotcha.
Now, in the garden, of course, you've got the plants you want and the plants you don't, for whatever complex mm-hmm. set of reasons, aesthetics or not. I tend to be much less tolerant of weeds in my garden. But one nice thing about being a weed scientist is that you can walk me into a new garden and I will not know your domestic plants. I'll look at them. I'll say they're beautiful, but uh-huh. I won't have any idea what they are.
And then you'll go, hey, nice weed.
Well, or I'll know what to pull. Uh-huh. I can weed somebody else's garden.
It's true.
Even if I haven't been to that garden before, because uh-huh. the weeds are the same almost all over the country.
Right. Nancy, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
You're welcome. I enjoyed being here.
Great. Thanks. Nancy Gift is the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love Plants We Don't Want. It's a personal and persuasive story about why we should pay more attention and more respect to what weeds can actually tell us about our environment. Nancy's also the acting director of the Rachel Carson Institute and an assistant professor of environmental studies at Chatham University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Of course, for more information on Nancy and her book, please see our website at WFPL.org. Coming up after the break, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Well, Miss Wishy, a couple questions for us geniuses here at the Homegrown Show.
Fire away.
First, a man named Alton has been growing red raspberries, he believes, of the Latham variety for mm-hmm. many years, but they died on them. He recalls reading or hearing years ago that there was some disease that would attack them, had no problem until recently. Do you know of the likely cause? Would it be okay to replant possibly another variety? I prefer the one crop rather than ever bearing.
Yeah, all the not all the brambles, but raspberries in particular are quite diseasey. There's all okay. kinds of, you know, bacterial, fungal diseases that can impact the canes. He mentions the prefer one crop rather than the everbearing, which is good because Alton, that's what we do. We actually have some everbearing varieties, but we treat them as the one crop varieties because one of the ways to offset disease is to cut them all the way back to the ground every year.
Right.
Like, for example, we've got two different varieties planted out right now. One of them is a royalty variety, Bob, a good red raspberry. And we sometimes experiment, which doesn't always work to your advantage. We cut some of them back and not all, and then other ones not all completely back.
That was my next question.
And the ones that we didn't completely cut back are diseasey.
Ah.
The ones that we did are fresher, but we're going to get fruit on them later in the season. You forgo that early crop for just the second crop. So I would look for Alton varieties like Royalty or Brandywine. There's a yellow variety called like Anne, something like that. Cultivate them in a way that you can harvest them in the summer, later in the summer, and then cut them back so that you never carry over that disease. Another thing, when you can replant, but I would not replant in the same area because there will be disease pathogens persistent in that area unless it goes empty for several years. So,
and I want to thank Alton for letting me hear the word diseasey again. I love it when you say that.
I mean, you know, it's the best way to describe this year, don't you think?
Yeah, it should be a new word. I'm with you, Kate.
Yeah. If I have to type it out, Bob, I at least go disease dash Y. So that kind of gives me a little
Z-E-E
bit of a
at
yeah.
The end.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good idea.
Diseasy, sure.
Diseasy. Maybe I'll try that.
Word
next
by
time.
Wishy, diseasy.
All right. Here's a question for you, yeah. Bob. Planted some bee balm in my heavily shaded side yard about 3 months ago. It looked great, and all three plants just recently bloomed. But today, two of the three plants appear to be on their way out, wilted, leaves shriveled, etc. The plants themselves are about 3 feet tall and spindly. Are you aware of anything I can do to save them? Should they not make it? Any ideas of other shade-loving plants I might try?
Yeah, the words bee balm and heavily shaded side yard should never be used in the same sentence.
Exactly. So
they're just not ever going to do well there, and that's part of the trouble.
They're like total full hardcore sun
yeah,
plants,
right.
So you just have them in the wrong place.
And they're problematic anyway.
And with all the rain that we had,
yeah.
Death for sure.
But there are some great plants. I use the stilbees.
Carex, which we're going to talk about next week in
oh, yeah.
More detail. There's some for shade.
Yeah.
All kinds of interesting ferns. I think my favorite fern is the beach fern.
Oh,
it
yeah.
It really fills out nicely. Hellebores are great.
Right, yep.
I've got some hardy begonias in our shade garden that we call Bob because we got them from you.
Variegated Solomon seal is nice.
Very nice.
I like those a lot.
Exactly.
It's just a bunch of shade-loving plants.
Lily of the Valley.
Yep.
You know what? Go to the shade section of your local nursery and peruse all the offerings that are there because there are lots of things, right, Bob?
Yes.
But somehow some wires got crossed because bee balm is not one of them.
No.
So dig those plants up now. You can save them. Dig them up now and stick them somewhere that's really sunny, and they should come back because they are tough plants, aren't
mm-hmm.
they? All right. There's another part to the question, Bob. From Joe. He also is wondering if you have any ideas other than napalm or mines to keep the squirrels out of his tomatoes.
This comes up quite a bit. Cages, mm-hmm. tall fence, living in a condo, growing in pots.
Yeah.
That's well, the three that come to mind.
And remember I told you I had a tip from a listener last week about using hot pepper flakes. Sprinkle
okay, yeah.
all the hot pepper
right.
flakes around your plants, you know, like you would put on pizza, and see if that helps.
Why not?
Why not? Exactly.
Go for it, Joe.
All right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
Oddly enough, in fact, Joe wrote a letter about this. it's Monarda.
Is it really bee balm?
I don't know how Joe knew that. Joe knew this, but he did,
no
yeah.
Kidding.
Perennial flower. It's called bee balm or bergamot.
Bergamot.
Or wild bergamot, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's a relative of the mint, very aromatic. It's heavily used, very colorful and prolific, but with a sad habit of developing mildew.
That's right.
Which it does in the sun, yeah. There's about 6 million cultivars, which is part of the problem. They've been bred anymore for disease or for color and not disease resistance. But this Jacob Klein was the plant of the year a couple of years ago, a tall red one. Marshall's Delight, Petite Delight, Pink Supreme, Purple Wonder, different colors. Hummingbirds, butterflies, and bees love them.
Mm-hmm.
It's got all kinds of great history. The genus was named for a Spanish physician, Nicolas Bautista Monardes.
Huh.
Isn't that a great name?
It is.
He lived from 1508 to 1588, and they're still talking about the guy. He lived in Seville, very close to his barber. And he had a great garden and plant importation business from the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first guy to write a book about plants found in the New World.
Cool.
A book with the great title of Joyful News Out of the New Found World, which he first described to Europeans, tobacco, cocoa, passion vine, and yes, sarsaparilla.
A true plantsman for sure.
He was.
Joyous.
500 years later, we're still talking about the guy. Going back even further, bee balm was known as the elixir of life. The bergamot name came in 1560 from the bergamot orange because its odor was similar to the orange.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know that.
You can make tea.
Yep, John Bartram
mm-hmm.
was credited with introducing bee balm tea to Europe. And before that, the Native Americans used it as tea, antiseptic, for teeth and skin and throat infections. And one, even today, one of the ingredients is thymol, is used in modern mouthwash.
Hmm.
How about that?
How about that?
Comes with a poem.
All right.
Have you ever had days with too much to do and wondered if plants had that problem too? Well, then consider the bee balm or bergamot if being way too busy has become your sad lot. It's loaded with history and medical tasks, flowers and odor, and what else, you asks? It's named for a Spaniard and fruit from a tree, quite orange in color, and then there's that tea. So whenever you tire and run out of steam, consider this option before perchancing to dream. Your life may be full, nothing but stops and starta, but it would be so much worse if your name were Monarda.
All right. Sounds good. It's a great plant, but definitely for full sun,
yep,
we'd have to
and
say.
And a little bit of white stuff in the end, but
yeah,
it's
worth it. That's all right. It is worth it. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, two big families of plants, begonias and carex. We're going to sort through some of those that are most garden-worthy.
Homegrown is produced by the always immaculate Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.